another question that came up was you described sati as meditation. That's mindfulness, right mindfulness as being meditation, when it was previously assumed that that was only the realm of samadhi. Another one that came up, which Venerable Karunika went around the monastery hunting down wrong views from people because she wasn't sure what myths would be busted today. And she said that one of the nuns mentioned that there are monastics out there who believe it's okay to have sex, drink, and break other precepts out of compassion for their disciples. and that, you know, and then somebody else had mentioned also that it seems to be that many people believe that morality section of the Noble Eightfold Path isn't required at all. If you've got enough wisdom, right view, meditation, jhana, that's all you really need. Another one that came up amongst quite a few people is how do you even identify right view from wrong view when you hear so many different Dhamma teachings and as lay people and some monastics as well, you don't necessarily have a lot of knowledge of the suttas or Pali. So it's great that we've got great teachers here, we think, but how do we really know? And how do you identify right view and misconceptions? You know, we don't think I've got any misconceptions, but yeah. Don't know. Another one was that someone thought that the different factors of the path sound as if they stand on their own. So you hear the list of right view, right speech, right action and all of those things, and it feels like that's all there is. But then you learn a little bit more and you realise actually just right view, you have to go to look at many other suttas to get an idea of what right view is. It's like a shorthand. It's not really the whole path in long form. It's just shorthand for what it is. One next thing was that someone wanted a bit more clarity over what, you know, if you can't carry over what you've done in this life, it kind of leaves you feeling a bit despairing. You know, maybe a bit more on how this works in terms of developing your mind. You know, you go to all this work to do the right thing and improve yourself, but if you die before you're enlightened, oh my goodness, what happens now? And then the last two were from Venerable Metaji. He was saying that he read something by Bhikkhu Bodhi about the intertwined nature of the factors. This sort of ties in a bit to one of the other questions earlier, in that it does feel like sometimes all of the factors come together and they're not necessarily that separate or sequential, but they can all be there at the same time. And the other one was that Tevija is rarely linked to the path. I mean, you get this long list of factors, but where does the path go? It doesn't really talk about the goal of the path. I think that's everything, and sorry if I forgot something.
Very good stuff.
We went off track really, really badly. So so we've got misconception about shorter paths, which were addressed by the Buddha in the suttas, that there are shorter paths.
Shorter paths, okay.
Yeah. Shortcuts.
Yeah. Shortcuts, yeah.
Yeah. Isn't there always a shortcut?
Yep. There is.
Yeah. And that it is the only path.
Misconception.
How do we know that it is the only path? That's all.
Okay. That's good. That's good.
Yeah. I think. So which group are you from? That's really fast. No wonder they're asking for shortcuts. I need to organize another workshop to learn from that shortcut.
Our team had the whole spectrum from, I just believe in everything that what is in the suttas and the early Buddhist text, so I'm not going to agree with anybody saying anything against that. to somebody saying, I'm not knowledgeable enough to comment on either the correct path or the wrong path or anything. So we had the whole spectrum. And the interesting ones are immediately you follow the Noble Eightfold Path, you become a disciple of the Buddha, irrespective of the level of the understanding, I guess. Then the other one had problems with various words, just an English term, used for various steps. Say, for example, view and understanding, etc. So that was a bit confusing. And then we had someone commenting that the right view is the most important one, and which is leads to Sakyaditti, and that is good enough, and that will lead to reaching the path. Then and a Noble Eightfold Path is only for noble people. The average people don't have to worry about it. Five precepts, and you know, what do you do? Good is good enough. Then somebody else thought the Bodhisattva path and the Noble Eightfold Path are one and the same. They didn't see the difference. Any one step is not critical, but going too detail into one step is not critical, but developing all of them together sort of is the most important thing to do. And somebody suggested that practice is more important than knowing the details and this terminology and all that. Don't worry about all the details, I suppose. Then there was quite a few saying that the sequence was probably unnecessary. Just follow it as one, or go randomly as you please or as you find it right. But the general consensus was practice is the important thing. I think I haven't missed anybody, I hope. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think Ajahn Brahmali is, I don't say pulling his hair out, but I can't use that phrase. He's like, oh my gosh, now there's like, I need to teach more because there's so many misconceptions.
This is why we shave.
That's why for the first time I see him taking out his notebook and starting writing.
In our group, Ajahn Brahmali said the misconception actually comes from the underestimation of the right view at the very beginning. A large amount of us got panicked because we worried that whatever we practice on the Noble Eightfold Path in this life cannot be carried forward to the next one. The third point of view is the sequential understanding of the path is too restrictive to follow. Like some other group had mentioned before, can all the factors be connected together and one thing leads to another, or it has to be come from the right view first and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The fourth one is not fully understanding the chaos in the Buddhist society, Buddhist teaching. In some other tradition, and therefore the Noble Eightfold Path is not correctly taught in some other traditions. Venerable
Chanti
said that don't let the misconception of the Noble Eightfold Path blinding you into the need to get enlightenment, because that's not the correct way to practice. And other stuff that we mentioned, we got sidetracked a little bit. So Nicholas mentioned that the point of Bodhisattva versus the Noble Eightfold Path, I couldn't understand that point as well, so I couldn't really elaborate on in the graduate process. Some people say the five precepts is enough. Misconception of external conflicts, like how do you maintain your right view if you're in a fight with somebody else that has a different view from you do? and some of the participants were quite happy with the practice in the Buddhist teaching in general. Thank you.
Do you want to say anything?
I feel that we have discombobulated some people.
We need to have...
They used to have a right view, and now they don't.
Now they have wrong view. Oh, dear. Oh,
and now
that's scary.
We need to have workshop number 7, Ajahn. Correct all the misconceptions.
Maybe we should stop with the workshops if it's going downhill, you know. Okay, well, I just want to, I'm not going to talk about all of this. Maybe I can just answer a few of these issues. because some of these are obviously, but a lot of groups were concerned about. The sequence seems to have been a big one, and the carrying over to next life seems to have been a fairly big one that many people were worrying about. Someone was talking about immorality and the kind of, you know, you can kind of abuse your disciples. We'll come to that later on, so we'll just leave that one out. I'll just talk briefly about those two things, because I think that was the more things that came up in many of the groups. So first of all, the idea of the sequence, yeah, and people thinking that it doesn't, sequence doesn't matter so much. And this shouldn't, we shouldn't overstate the idea of sequence. It doesn't mean that you kind of have to stick with a right view and just work on that, not do anything else. The idea is just that even to be a moral person, you have to have some degree of right view. You cannot really be moral if you don't have an idea that morality is useful or it's good. Yeah, you have to have some kind of view there which supports the idea of morality. And you can also meditate with, you know, you can start meditating straight away. But the point is that that meditation is only going to go so far if it isn't supported by the previous factors. The previous factors help you, the meditation, to become strong and established. It allows mindfulness to become powerful. So the previous factors are important insofar as they get you started at all, and also in supporting the growth later on. Yeah, as you kind of develop yourself, they support the development. So if meditation isn't going so well, you need to look earlier on the path. You don't need to look at the mechanics of meditation or anything like that. And also, it is also true, and this is what we talked about last time, that there is also a feedback mechanism. So the later factors will support the earlier ones. Yeah. So if your meditation is going well, you gain a degree of clarity of mind, you have more metta and compassion for beings, of course, that will support you in your ability to be kind, yeah, and to be moral, and to have the mindfulness to know what's happening in your mind. So all the factors do work together, but the root kind of sequence is from view onwards, because without that right view, to some extent, nothing at all happens. So this should not be taken too far, the idea of a sequence. Yeah, they are intertwined in a deeper sense.
Exactly. So they are intertwined. So it was a misconception. Yeah. People thought that somehow they learned here now that we have to follow the sequence. No, that's what I always got worried. No, that's not a misconception. It is automatic path and it is intertwined.
Mm.
And no, you don't have to remember this sequence. Don't worry about it. It is automatic.
Yeah.
As long as you can listen to Ajahn Brahm's Dhamma talks, you get inspired, you keep meditating, you know, your wholesomeness grows, your inspiration grows, happiness grows. It's automatic.
Hmm. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Okay. Yeah. No, okay.
That or, yeah.
No, I'm being naughty. Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So but what if it isn't automatic? Yeah.
Drink more coffee.
What if have more coffee? That's the path forward. Okay. Well, I'll trust you.
Seems to be working.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's good. Okay. So let's go on to the next one. The other big thing that was a hurdle for people was the idea of, well, what about the next life? Yeah, there was a couple of people, or three people, even on our group, was asking about that. So it seems kind of terrible, yeah, if you put in all this practice and your next life comes around and you start from scratch. Oh, no, everything is gone. Yeah, I can see why that is a lot of dukkha. Dukkha means suffering, by the way, so I shouldn't use Pali words. So remember the idea here, and this is also the idea of kamma. What is actually kamma? Now, kamma is, strictly speaking, only the connection between the acts that you do in one life, in other words, the intention that you have, and how you feel about yourself. Yeah, that's strictly speaking what kamma is about. So if you have good intentions, you will feel good about yourself. Yeah, you know that in this life, if you're kind to somebody, how do you feel afterwards? You feel quite good. You feel like lifted up. You feel, yay. You don't feel a big ego necessarily, or hopefully not, but you feel this general sense of warmth inside of you. You feel good about yourself. Yeah, it's that kind of self-esteem almost. So that is what kamma is about. It's a connection between intention and how you feel. But of course, that doesn't really fit with the Noble Eightfold Path, because the Noble Eightfold Path is not a feeling. It is a way of thinking about the world. So that has more to do with habit. But habit is a very important mechanism that also transfers from one life to another one. So if you have certain habits, if you are an angry person in this life, you will tend to be angry in the future life. Not because there is a karmic connection, because there's no kind of intention to feeling thing there. It's just that anger is just like in this life, if you are generally angry, that anger tends to carry on unless you change. In the same way, in the future life, if you have a tendency in this life, you carry on in the future life. If you learn French in this life, in your next life, you may speak French. Yes, you know what people suddenly speak a foreign language. You heard about those things called xenoglossy. Xenoforeign glossy is like language. Yes, so the idea of xenoglossy is you speak a foreign language without knowing that you're doing it. And that would come then as a habit from a previous life, just happening because you knew it before. So those two things go together. Yeah. Yeah. Two things, right? One is the karma, which is intention relating to how you feel, and then the habits that you have, which go from one life to the next one. And so if you have a habitual person who enjoys the Buddhist teachings, and you have a habit to live the spiritual life, and that habit, if you make that very strong in this life, it will tend to carry on also in the future life. No, intention matters. If you step on an ant by accident, you do not pay for that. Okay. That's not what the Buddha taught. But anyway, Okay. So if you have a question, let's wait till the question time, and then we'll invite you up and you can ask your questions. Otherwise, it gets too many things happening here. So, and that is the way, and this is also something you actually find in the suttas. Yeah, you find in the suttas, the Buddha says that if you practice well in this life, if you understand the Buddha's teachings, then you realize in the next life, you will tend to remember, you tend to know that this is the Buddha's teaching. Wow, I've heard this before somewhere. What is this? There's something familiar about this. And then you incline towards the Buddha's teachings because you were there in the past life. Yeah. So those are the two things that work together, and that is, for that reason, it tends to carry on.
Ajahn, could you say something about paramis? Is that sometimes comes quite often as a monk? People ask about
paramis is all related to the bodhisattva ideal.
Yeah.
So the word occurs in the suttas, but it doesn't mean paramis in the same way. It means just a kind of an excellent thing or something. But later on, the paramis are the qualities that you're supposed to develop on the bodhisattva path. The 6 paramis in Mahayana, 10 in Theravada, and they're closely related to the Eightfold Path. The difference isn't that great. There's a little, some small differences, but not, the basic ideas are largely the same. Samadhi practice, sila practice, generosity, all of those things are included, but it's a bit more involved sometimes.
Okay.
Anyway, so okay. Everyone okay with that? Does anyone want to say anything more about this? I'm not sure if I touched on everyone's. We probably didn't touch on everyone's question, but it's almost impossible. There's so many. There's how many people here, and there's equally number of opinions usually. So it's can't really do every one of them. Everyone okay? Yeah. Okay. Good. So let's then carry on. Okay, so this is the next misconception about the path, and that is the idea that not all 8 factors are equally important. Yeah, some of the factors you might be able to eliminate them altogether. Maybe right view doesn't matter so much. Yeah, some people might argue that, or maybe samadhi doesn't matter so much, or as someone said, maybe morality isn't really that important. So the question is, are all factors equally important? And what we're going to look at is the following here. So these are the typical factors that kind of get singled out as not being important or as being really important. So you have right view is not really required. A lot of people will argue that some of the aspects of right view are not, you know, you can take them out and you can still practice properly.
Could you say which ones they usually leave out?
Well, like rebirth, you know, it's classical, oh, right. Okay, classical, yeah. One. Yeah, yeah. So forget about rebirth, doesn't matter. You can still practice the path. Morality, yeah, is not so important. We'll talk about these in detail in a second. I'm just kind of going through them quickly, and then we can look at them because they're all coming up afterwards. So the idea of taking out morality, all you do is, you know, you just sit down and become still and you enjoy the peace of meditation. Mindfulness is sufficient. You know, the modern kind of mindfulness movements, when mindfulness becomes the be-all and end-all of practice, or the Buddhist practice. And of course, that stillness is not required. You can take out the idea of samadhi, and you don't really have to worry about samadhi because it is too hard to have find samadhi. Yeah, because it's too hard, we leave it out. Maybe that's not the right way to think. But anyway, this is what sometimes is kind of said. Yeah, so leave out some of the factors. So now we're going to discuss these in quite a bit more detail. We're going to start with right view.
That's me, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I think it's just two slides. So let me go for the previous one. So factors are typically singled out. Okay. Okay, so another sutta quote. If it turns out there is another world and good and bad deeds have a result, then when the body breaks up after death, I'll be reborn in a good place, heavenly realm. This is the first consolation they won. So my mind doesn't work. Let me just read the next one. Oh, that's the consolation, right? I understand that. So when you do good, good things happen to you. So in this lifetime, even you, if you do good bad deeds or good deeds, the results are in this lifetime. So you don't have to wait until next lifetime to get born as a home cat, as a domestic cat to, you know, just enjoy your life. I just had to add these cat pictures. I don't know. Anyways. Yeah. All right. So if it turns out there is no other world and good and bad deeds don't have result, then in the present life, I'll keep myself free of enmity, ill will, untroubled and happy. This is the second consolation, the one. So this is from the what usually it's called the Kalama Sutta, it's for the Buddha taught, Buddha was teaching the Kalamas. And so it's a, let me go back to the right factors, what the typically singled out. So with the, you don't have to believe in rebirth. So you can just have, like in this sutta, it says, well, you don't have to, it's believe in next rebirth, because in this lifetime, if you do good, you'll be happy, right? If it turns out there is there's a life after this, you still win. So in this sense, it's a right view is not required because you don't have to believe in rebirth.
Yeah, so the suttas are supporting the idea that right view doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what are we to make of that?
I don't know what to say.
Yes, you do. The suttas are supporting right view doesn't matter because regardless, you can have the consolation. If there is rebirth, well, I have gone good, I'm going to be okay. So if there is no rebirth, I'll still be happy. So forget about right view.
Right, so you don't have to believe in rebirth. Yeah. And there's a famous teacher coming after this. So the doctrine of rebirth is meaningful in Buddhism only insofar as it provides a basis for continuity of ethical consequences. Right? Although rebirth and karma are often linked together, it is karma that's primary importance. Rebirth is in secondary. So do you understand? So in here, so basically what this famous teacher is saying, that it is actually what matters is that what happens in this lifetime. You don't have to believe in rebirth. Is this right? Some famous teachers, other teachers in Buddhism would say, no, you have to believe in rebirth, in otherwise this path, there is no point for this path. Let's say if the right view was that there is, you live once and then I still be happy. Is there still doesn't the path, there is no point of following this path if it was only one lifetime. And let's see this famous teacher, how do you argue this?
Who is the most famous teacher in Buddhism?
The Buddha?
Ah!
Oh, I thought it's you! So what about the Kalama Sutta then?
Yeah.
Can you leave it out?
So it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the point is, it's not just this sutta, there's also the Appanaka Sutta, Majjhima 60, which has a similar kind of idea of consolation, yeah? And the idea of the Kalama Sutta is that these are newcomers, yeah?
Right.
And you are a newcomer, you haven't decided on your spiritual path. So then you have a kind of an overview, someone who is standing outside and saying, well, okay, so regardless of how I think about the world, whether there is rebirth or not, I don't really know. And very few people actually know these things. You may have faith or confidence there is rebirth, but you don't know. Well, even if you don't know about it, still, morality pays off. That it is what it's saying. Yeah,
right.
It pays off regardless. This is for people who are new to the Buddhist teaching. It doesn't mean that this view doesn't matter. It just means that when you start out and you are uncertain about these things, still you have grounds for being moral. That's what it is about. Yeah. But of course, rebirth matters enormously because then suddenly the scope for future results, the scope for where you're heading, suddenly just expands out almost infinitely. Yeah. So of course it matters enormously. Mm. Yeah. And you are more likely, I think, far more likely to live a spiritual life if there is rebirth. If you just die and everything comes to an end, spiritual life doesn't make all that much sense. And I think being a monastic makes less sense if there is no rebirth. And you know, Stephen Batchelor was a classic example of someone who used to be a monastic, he became a layperson.
Right.
And it may, I'm not saying it is, but it may be related to the absence of belief in rebirth, possibly.
Okay.
That view may have actually turned him away, because suddenly, the consequences are far, far more significant if there is such a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It starts to feel like ascetic practice. It starts to feel like you are restraining too much. Because there is only one lifetime. What's the point of I'm striving so hard? If it comes to an end, it's almost like you lose. There's no win-win if you become monastic.
Yeah,
for example.
If you not enjoy, especially if you don't enjoy the monastic life, if you enjoy it anyway because your meditation is really good, of course, then it doesn't matter.
That's true.
So
it's sort of like a starting point, and I think a lot of people, there's nothing wrong about this. Like Ajahn Pramali was saying, but the scope, and that's a good way to look at it, the scope becomes so much bigger when you think about that. It's many, many lifetimes to come.
Yeah. And I think and very important point, when you read the suttas like this, sometimes we choose the suttas that we like. And it's typical that the Kalama Sutta is chosen by some people and are kind of given prominence. But that is really the wrong way. This says something about how we should be reading the suttas. We should be very careful to read everything and put everything into its rightful place, so everything fits in with the overall idea. But if you cannot use the Kalama Sutta to, for example, one of the classical things in the Kalama Sutta, it says, don't believe in tradition, don't believe the scriptures,
So then
they will use the Kalama Sutta to say, no need to read the suttas. But you're using the suttas to say, don't read the suttas, So you can see why that is problematic, It is very problematic. So the right way, if you have confidence in Buddhism, is to read the suttas overall, to have a full understanding of what is going on, then make the things fall into place according to the overall picture. It's one big picture, and everything should fit into that picture. Huh? And there's and this kind of thing is the same. So you see that right view obviously is significant. Beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha talks about right view everywhere. So this then must somehow fit into that.
don't abuse the teachings into your own benefit.
Basically. Yeah. Or don't fit the teachings into your own views. Yes. Match your own views with the teachings. Right. So, yeah.
But the Kalama Sutta, what it's saying, basically, what it comes down to, that the teaching should match how the reality is. So don't believe your own views too much, and don't just take other people's views if they're teaching something. It has to match how it is, the reality of it is. Okay, let's see what the next one is. Morality is less important. Oh, this is from the Sanyutta. What is the starting point of skillful qualities? Well-purified ethics and correct view. When your ethics are well-purified and your view is correct, you should develop the four kinds of mindfulness meditation in three ways, depending on and grounded on ethics. So morality is less important. So this is, the Buddha is actually saying something else in the Sanyutta Nikaya here, that the starting point, it is the skillful qualities, your kindness, your ethics, that you have to get this right. And here we have again what was asked, the four kinds of mindfulness meditation, what was asked in the question.
Satipatthanas.
Four satipatthanas.
Yeah. So the point here is that, very, very commonly in the Buddhist world is that people start out as meditating from scratch. Yeah, they come into meditation center, sits down, and you meditate often for hours and hours on end. And while you're there, you keep the precepts. But when you leave again, you're not really taught that, keeping morality is important at all times. And you just meditate without that. Or the modern mindfulness movement is often very similar. You're just mindful of the content of your mind. And then it stops. It doesn't go any further. It has a very limited effect. And that is precisely for this reason, that only meditation really only works and takes off and is powerful when it is based on ethics or morality. This is the foundation for all meditation practice. Why? Why is that? Why is ethics so important? Yeah, these are really useful questions to ask. Why does it matter? Because if you understand why it matters, then you gain more confidence that this is true. It's not really enough just to say that this is the case. Why does it matter? Yeah, so you're saying that your mind is very agitated and things, if you have a lot of craving and desires going on, so morality is important, yes. So that morality is important for a number of reasons. One is the fact that if you're moral, you tend to feel good about yourself. Yeah, if you treat people well, you feel, you're contented with your life and who you are. And that feeling good about yourself is necessary because meditation is all about contentment and happiness and joy in the meditation practice. If you haven't got that as a foundation, it is not going to work out. But the second thing is that if you are going to succeed in meditation, you have to, the mind has to be relatively still. Part of meditation practice is to be able to stay with the object, like the breath, for example. To be able to stay with the breath, if you have too many desires or ill will or whatever going on in your mind, it's going to take you away from the present moment. The whole idea here is to be able to stay in the present moment. You have to reduce your defilements. Yeah. So the more purified your ethics are, the more ability you will have to just relax in meditation and enjoy what is going on. It's very kind of obvious when you think about it. You feel good about yourself, so the present moment is happy. When the present moment is happy, it is easy to stay in the present moment. If the present moment is miserable, of course, the mind is going to go into the future, go into the past, go into the fantasy land, etc., etc. Yeah, so that is. Would you mind if we wait? We'll be stopping soon for a bit of meditation, and we'll come back to you afterwards. Is that okay? Yeah. So just. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, no, I agree with that. The more you can live like that, the better it is. So that's yeah. Great. Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. All right. I think, should we read this two more from the Sanyutta Nikaya?
Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Go for it.
It shouldn't take that long. This is. Yeah. These are all. We actually were thinking about this with Ajahn Brahm yesterday, and we found some really nice saying from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Without fulfilling the practice of trainee, it is impossible to fulfill the ethics. Without fulfilling the ethics, it is impossible to fulfill the right view. Without fulfilling the right view, it is impossible to fulfill the right stillness. So in this way, the sila is actually, in here we have, we started with the trainee, so that's sort of like your basic sila, your basic practices, and then you become like a trainee. Maybe Seika would be, maybe you would say that it's actually already in the path, but...
No, because right view comes afterwards.
So right view comes afterwards, so it's not. Okay, so yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So, but it's quite a nice saying here in Anguttara Nikaya that without your ethics, you cannot go to the right view. So having that kindness without the basic purity of the mind, you cannot even... get into the beginning of the path. Because earlier you were saying there's a lot of people thought you have to have the right view first in order to get there. Well, actually there's something before the right view, and there's something before. So it's all just goes in sequences and around and around. But sila is always a good starting point.
So yeah, but I think here the point of right view here is that it means the stream entry, it means the full right view. Yeah. And of course to get there you have to have ethics first. Yeah. But then you have to have another more preliminary right view to even get to ethics, yeah. So there's kind of degrees here, and that's why it looks like this.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think one of the interesting things here is also just the right stillness, samma samadhi.
Yeah.
To be able to come to the end of the path, it's impossible without morality at the beginning. That's what it's saying, really. Yeah. Mm. And that's kind of yeah.
And there's one more from the same. Okay. Monks, an unethical person who lacks ethics has destroyed the vital condition for stillness. When there is no stillness, one who lacks right stillness has destroyed the vital condition for true knowledge and vision. So that means coming to the end of the path. This is the Nibbana. So if you don't have ethics, it says the same thing. Basically, you cannot have the right samadhi. Without the right samadhi, you cannot have the Nibbana. Round and round we go. There's these three things we found in the AN. I think that's it. We should have a break, maybe.
One more.
Is there?
Yeah.
Oh, no. All right. For a person endowed with virtue, freedom from remorse. So this is what Ajahn Brahmali was talking earlier. So from virtue comes freedom from remorse. What comes from freedom from remorse is joy. So because you don't have remorse in mind, you're joyous. What comes from joy? Become even more joyful. Rapture. From rapture, your body becomes calm. Right? We're going deeper and deeper in meditation. What comes from the calm body? Pleasure. And
sukha.
Sukha, right. So it's interesting. So calmer and the calmer you get, more pleasure you get in the body and mind. What comes from pleasure? You get, how did that happen? We forgot to edit. What's the problem here? Concentration. No pleasure, you don't get concentrated. You get calm, still, right? So this is a really good thing. And Ajahn Brahmali teaches this in his all of his, usually when he teaches meditation retreats, that we always have to remember that in Buddhism, we don't try to punish ourselves, that we try to get more and more pleasure. Pleasure from the mind and body. And then from that you become stilled, and then you get more virtue. All right, so that's it.
Is there one more, or is there? No, that's it. Okay, yeah, go back again. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's do a little bit of meditation to get us to chill a little bit. Okay, everyone. So let's carry on. Any questions or comments, anything anyone would like to make at this point? Can we have a microphone, please, for Venerable? Yeah?
No, I was just wondering if we could just go back two slides. I just wanted to jot down the number of the sutta, the one about the trainee.
It will all eventually go on the Buddha Society website, Venerable, so you will be able to find it there. Yeah, 521.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of, we find all of these in the Anguttara Nikaya, so, which is actually last night, I asked Gajahn Brahm the questions like, what does he know as suttas where he says, no sila, no jhana? And he said, oh, that's an interesting question. But yeah, we find these in last night with Ajahn Brahmali, so these are actually very inspiring, all of them, when you look at them. Could you take the microphone, please, because we've been always asked to.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was just a clarity on ethics. Like, I'm a little bit confused by that, just because don't different cultures have a different ethical sort of standard? Like, what I think is ethical, someone else might not. So where's the clarity in that?
Okay. So we're going to talk a lot more about ethics later on this course, because it is such an important part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, we write speech, we write action, all of that. But from the Buddhist idea, the basic idea of ethics is where you're coming from. What is your motivation in doing something? Are you doing it because of ill will, greed, and delusion? Or are you doing it? Are you coming from kindness and generosity and understanding? And that is really, in Buddhism, how we would decide whether something is considered ethical or unethical. And these are universal traits, in people, whether they're coming from something wholesome or unwholesome in that sense. There are some slightly grayish areas. There's always a few grayish areas in these things. So it's not 100% clear cut always, but that gives you a very, very good foundation for deciding what is ethical and what is not. Okay. So, shall we carry on? Are you ready for more? Yeah? Okay. Good. Okay. Let's carry on. So we had a look at two of these things. The first, the idea that your right view is not so important. Whether you believe in rebirth or not, but actually in the suttas, right view, as we have seen, is at the very beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so it is fundamental. We also saw that it is fundamental for the practice of meditation. The Pali word is ujjukaditti, straight view. You need that even to be able to meditate. And that's kind of fascinating here. I'm not going to talk about why that is now, but it's just fascinating to see that it's there. So when people, this idea that right view doesn't matter so much is not really founded in the suttas. Morality is less important. We had a look at that, seen how important morality is to enable the whole path to unfold. It doesn't really unfold without that morality. And now we're going to have a look at the last two of these things. And the first one of these is the idea that right mindfulness is sufficient. And you find this is a very common thing that you will, in the present day, when you have the whole mindfulness movement where people are taught mindfulness to regulate their emotions and to be able to live in a more, I suppose, wholesome way or good way or at ease with people around them because they have better emotional regulation and all of these things. But it kind of take mindfulness out of the Buddhist path, and they present it as one thing. In fact, they don't even tell you that it is Buddhism anymore. They take mindfulness completely out of its original context and present it as a kind of secular teaching. Mindfulness will help you. And of course, there is some truth to that. Mindfulness will always be helpful. But the problem is that without the context, it will only take you, it will only go so far, it will only do a little bit for you, and very quickly you come up against obstacles. The mindfulness doesn't sharpen, it doesn't allow you to do the things that you wanted to do. It's a very common thing. So this is very problematic. And the other problem is that the mindfulness that they teach very often in a kind of secular context is not really the mindfulness the Buddha had in mind anyway. Yeah. If you look at the suttas, mindfulness is factor number 7 on the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's a very particular kind of mindfulness. It is the mindfulness that enables meditation. Yeah, it's the mindfulness you have when you watch the breath, for example. It's a very subtle kind of mindfulness. The ability to stay with the breath or watch the breath is actually, as many of you may have noticed, it's not always that easy. Yeah, your mind goes here, goes there, or you fall asleep, or you know, you fantasize about something. But actually, it doesn't happen naturally. And so the mindfulness they talk about in secular mindfulness is more a preliminary mindfulness that we would call sati sampajanya in Pali. Sati, mindfulness, sampajanya, clear awareness. It's a more preliminary thing that helps you to regulate the mind and to make sure the mind is reasonably wholesome. So it's not even quite the same thing here. So that, I think, is a very important point also to keep in mind. Okay, so now what have we got here? So this is a really nice sutta quote to show you the limitations of mindfulness. Yeah, and this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. This is the Yakka Samyutta. You know about the Yakka Samyutta? You know yakshas, yeah? Yakkas, you know, yakkas are these very interesting beings in Buddhism. They're like these kind of demons or ogres. So this is the whole sutta about these demons. Yeah, a whole sequence of suttas about this, the yakkas. Yakkas are very famous in Buddhist history and Buddhist culture. Yakkas are the ones that steal the children from people, and sometimes they're supposed to eat children, yeah, according to some of the stories. And they do naughty things also in the suttas. Yakkas, they come and they clobber Venerable Sariputta on the head. Yeah, this yakka comes with a big sledgehammer and kind of gives Venerable Sariputta a good whack on the head. And Venerable Sariputta happens to be in meditation, yeah, and Venerable Mahamoggallana is sitting next to him. And after he comes out of meditation, Venerable Mahamoggallana says to Venerable Sariputta, "Oh, you know, how does your head feel?" "Oh, I got a bit of a headache." And then when Mahamoggallana said, "Wow, that's amazing. You know, anyone else, if this yakka had hit even an elephant on the head, that elephant would have been destroyed straight away. But all you feel is a little bit of a headache. That's the power of your meditation." Yeah. Anyway, just a story about yakkas. It had nothing to do with this. But I hope you will forgive me. Hope you will forgive me for that. So this is, anyway, I'm just to give you the background about the yakkas. Yeah, so these are yakka in this one. These are the good yakkas. These are the yakkas that are Buddhist. Yeah, and they want to know about mindfulness, just like everyone wants to know about mindfulness now. Nothing has changed in 2,500 years. Everyone wants to know about mindfulness. This is the discussion between the Buddha and a yakka. So this is what the Buddha replies. It's always auspicious for the mindful. The mindful prosper in happiness. Each new day is better for the mindful, but they're not freed from enmity. Enmity is vera, it's like hatred, anger. That's an interesting point, isn't it? Because very often when we think about the Buddhist teachings about, you know, we are told you should always be mindful. This is a very typical Buddhist teachings that you hear a lot in the world. Always be mindful. This is a very important thing. And the idea is that will help you to overcome defilements of the mind, ill will, anger, or whatever. But here the Buddha is specifically saying that it is not enough. You're not freed from ill will simply by being mindful. So what do you have to do? But someone whose mind delights in harmlessness all day and all night, with love for all living creatures, they have no enmity for anyone. So here, the point is that you need to have metta. This metta is the word here, love, loving kindness. Is Bhantasuddhato's translation. He translates metta as love. So loving kindness. You need to have metta to be able to overcome ill will. This is really, I think, very interesting. It shows you the limitations of mindfulness. And it gives you an idea why we should be mindful in the first place. Very often you are told, you know, be mindful all the time, because if you're mindful all the time, that's good. But But it's very rarely specified exactly why it is good. Why should we be mindful all the time? Sounds like a good idea, right? But why exactly is it a good idea? And on the preliminary stages of the path, we are trying to overcome defilements, because when we overcome defilements, that is exactly what enables us to meditate. That's what enables us to gain stillness of the mind. We saw this before, all of the suttas showing the connection between ethics and mindfulness and then stillness. Yeah, so this is the preliminary thing. We should overcome the defilements of the mind. And the purpose of mindfulness is to enable us to see the defilements, to be aware of what is going on in the present moment. Yeah, and then when the negative mind arises, then we don't necessarily use mindfulness, then we use metta, or we use some other perception to overcome the defilement. So we have to know fairly clearly what it is that we're trying to do. How does this path work? Yeah, and then when we know how the path works, we can apply the right remedy at the right time. So the purpose of mindfulness, especially in the early times, is to have enough clarity to understand what is going on, so you can apply the right remedy to overcome enmity, desire, whatever else that is happening in your mind. So this is a very important counterexample to the kind of mindfulness-only idea, that actually, no, you need to do much more than that. Mindfulness in itself is not sufficient. You need to expand out. So it's not sufficient in the early stages of the path, because you need to always use morality to overcome defilements. And then it is not sufficient on the later stages of the path, because you need to go beyond mindfulness. You need to use mindfulness to go to stillness. Sati, mindfulness, leads to samadhi, stillness of the mind. You need all of those things, and only then does the path become complete. Yeah, and then you start to see the whole pictures. This idea of mindfulness alone and this very massive emphasis on mindfulness, it's fine, but it's going to be limited. If you really want to practice the Buddha's teachings, you need all eight factors of the path.
Yep, I like the idea that you always have to remember, just with the mindfulness, look what's in the mind, but you have to have the actually see, okay, well, I have hatred there in the mind, or whatever it is. That those are the ones you talk about defilements. Maybe not everybody knows about what defilements are, what we mean by defilements. Sometimes it's a bit obscure, but quite often you see greed or hatred. Quite often I see in my mind desires for something. Well, you apply the remedy, like you said, metta, and it's quite common for us to teach. You don't fight the anger. I shouldn't be angry. I shouldn't be, when you're meditating. No, that's when you have time to apply kindness towards that, and that will dissipate. And then you have happiness, and then you keep moving on this way.
Mm.
You are harmless towards your own anger.
Kind to your own anger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. So the last one is the idea that samadhi, right stillness, is not required. Yeah, it's a very common idea in Buddhism. Yeah, and one of the reasons why this sort of view arises, two reasons. First of all, not reading the suttas. Yeah, if you don't read the suttas, how on earth would you know? If you start reading the suttas and you find that every other sutta talks about samadhi or samadhi, it becomes very obvious after a while that this is a very important teaching of the Buddha. Yeah, so this is one reason why it occurs. The other one, as I mentioned before, well, it's so hard. Yeah, I can't get to samadhi. I wonder if there is a shortcut. Someone talked about the shortcut before. Yeah, they went, what was the question again about the shortcut? Something about, anyway, there was something about shortcuts. Everyone wants to have a shortcut. Why can't we make it shorter? Well, the Noble Eightfold Path, that is the shortcut. Yeah, that's where we go wrong. We have been given the shortcut by the Buddha. It's all the other ones. Yeah, those are the kind of the long cuts. Yeah, or whatever it is. We have the shortcut already. That is the whole point. Everything else is a detour, and it's going to keep you going. And as far as I can tell, the Bodhisattva practice can be, depending on how you do it, can also be a detour if you get it wrong. Yeah. So that is So we have the shortcut, and that is what we're given, and you can't really pare it back anymore. And we will have a look at the sutta, which makes a specific point in a second here. So right stillness is not required. It's a very common idea in Buddhism, and a lot of some meditation systems try to do away with samadhi and teach a path that ends with right mindfulness, and then they kind of does that in various ways to try to get around this. I'm not going to go into all the technical details because I think probably most of you would start falling asleep if I did that, so I will spare you that. But so let's see what the Buddha has to say about right stillness. Yes, this is a classic example. This is from Majjhima Nikaya 64, the middling sayings of the Buddha, Sutta 64. It is called the Mahamalunkya Putta Sutta, the greatest sutta to Mahamalunkya, or Mahamalunkya Putta, or whatever in here. So that's the name of the fellow, Mahamalunkya Putta. Do you like that name? Unusual name. Anyway, that's his name. So he goes to the Buddha. I think that's Matsuta. Anyway, he goes to the Buddha and they talk about the path. And this is what the Buddha has to say in this particular case. This is one of the similes used by the Buddha. Suppose there was a large tree standing with heartwood. Yeah, heartwood, a solid wood in the middle. It is not possible to cut out the heartwood without having cut through the bark and the softwood. Yeah? In the same way, there is a path and practice for giving up the five lower fetters. In other words, the five basic defilements, yeah, or problems of the mind. It is not possible to know or see or give up the five lower fetters without relying on that path and that practice. Yeah. In other words, if you don't practice this particular path, it is impossible, the Buddha is saying here, to give up those five fetters. In other words, it's impossible to become enlightened, yeah, or awakened, or reach deep stages of spiritual excellence, whatever you want to call it. You cannot be done. It's not possible. Netang tanang vijjati. There is no such case is found, is literally what the Pali means. What is that? And what, Ananda, is the path and the practice for giving up these five lower fetters? In other words, what is that path to awakening? The answer is the four jhanas. And then it also adds the three immaterial attainments as well. Four jhanas is the sammasamadhi. Yeah, this is the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Cannot be done. You can't become enlightened without this. I know what you think, but I think to me that's pretty powerful testimony from the Buddha. I can't really say things more powerful than that. It's impossible to do without it. Anyway, that's the first one. Next one. Right stillness, still about right stillness not being required. When there is no right stillness, one who lacks right stillness has destroyed a vital condition for true knowledge and vision. Yeah, true knowledge and vision, yatta, bhuta, jnana, dasana in Pali. Yeah, see, knowing and seeing according to reality. When there is no samma, samadhi, right stillness, you lack the vital condition for that. Upanisa is the Pali here. Yeah, this is very powerful. And this particular sutta, this sequence that you find here, is one that actually occurs everywhere in the suttas, again and again. It's one of the core ways that the Buddha teaches the Dhamma. It's part of what sometimes is called dependent liberation. That's the, anyway, word that I tend to use. Yeah. So without that, there is no seeing things according to reality. And seeing things according to reality, well, that is precisely things like stream entry or arahantship. Yeah. So according to this, it looks like even stream entry is impossible without samadhi. And this is one of those old arguments, yeah? Is it possible to become a stream mentor without samadhi, without the jhanas? One of those things. And if you look at this particular saying here, it almost looks like it, doesn't it? Yeah, without right stillness, you're lacking the condition for true knowledge and vision, which is stream entry, in other words, the first stage of awakening, it is lacking. It almost looks like it is impossible. It's certainly a statement very much in favor of the jhanas and samadhi. So is it absolute? And now we come to this fascinating question. Yeah, is it possible to become a stream enterer without jhanas? Is it possible to become enlightened without the jhanas? Everyone loves this question. Is anyone here who does not interest in that question? Everyone interested in this question, okay. Classic question. Yeah, you always get asked this question. And the answer is, well, I would say this particular saying is the closest you get in the suttas to saying how important it is, yeah? It is almost saying that it is required, but maybe not 100%. It depends a little bit how you phrase this. The way that, this is Adan Sudato's translation, the way he has phrased it, it sounds like it is an absolute requirement, but you could maybe translate it slightly differently. Yeah? So it is still a little bit open, but it shows you how important it is, yeah? And it is really to the point where it would be silly to argue that it isn't required. But the most important thing about this whole discussion is that, to my mind, it is really the kind of wrong question to ask. Is it required? Because what are you going to use that information for? If I tell you it isn't required, how are you going to use that information? I can say, oh yeah, in that case, forget about it. But that would be the wrong take-home message, yeah? That would be the wrong message. The point is that there is a path. It's called the Noble Eightfold Path. As you practice that path, stream entry will happen. You become enlightened as you practice that path. You shouldn't stop kind of halfway and say, yeah, this is enough because this last part isn't required. You should keep on practicing until stream entry happens. If stream entry happens before you get to jhanas, yay, marvelous. If it doesn't happen, don't stop. Carry on. Yeah, this is the path. So the question is often kind of irrelevant. Yeah, it doesn't matter if jhana is 100% required or not. Your job is just to practice the path. And then eventually the results will come as a consequence of practicing the path. So I don't know, to me that question is not all that useful. That's how I see it. You can complain about this in a second if you don't agree with this, but anyway, I agree with this. So so let's summarize all of these things a little bit. Yeah, so the Buddhist path is just right. Yeah, this is one of the things that we see in the suttas. What we have is just the right thing. Yeah, just this is the path. There is no other for insight and for purity, or for the purification of insight, if you like. Yeah. You should enter this path. This is the confounding of Mara, famous verse from Dhammapada. And here's another one which I really like. This is from a sutta called the Pasadika Sutta in the Long Discourses of the Buddha, Digha Nikaya. And it says that if anyone were to refer to a spiritual life as well proclaimed and complete in all aspects, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, it is this spiritual life they would be describing. Yeah? Nothing is lacking. In other words, what you find in the suttas is a complete description of the spiritual life. You don't need anything else. You don't need the Abhidhamma. You don't need the Mahayana suttas. You don't need the Visuddhimagga. You don't need all of this later stuff. The Buddha has already given us a complete description of the path. In fact, there's always a little bit of a danger if we use too much of the later things, because there's a danger that we may go astray, especially if we only rely on the later things and we kind of forget about the early suttas. Then there is a great danger there. Yeah, because we have nothing, things aren't really anchored in anything. They aren't anchored in the word of the Buddha. So we can use the later stuff, but we should make sure that it is anchored in the word of the Buddha, because that is where we find nothing is lacking. We don't need anything more. And nothing is superfluous. There's nothing missing. Sammasamadhi is not superfluous. Right view is not superfluous. Morality is not superfluous. All of these things are required. Yeah, they are part of the path. If we don't do these things, then we are missing fundamental aspects of what makes the path possible. And then, of course, we're not going to make it to the end. We're not going to have these profound insights the Buddha is talking about. So don't chuck anything out. If you do, likelihood is you won't get to the results the Buddha is talking about. And this is so important, yeah, because we are talking here about the meaning of life. We're talking about finding the highest contentment, the overcoming of suffering and problems in life. Yeah, this is really what life, the purpose of life. We're chucking out the purpose of life, the meaning of life, if we detract from this path, we subtract some of the factors. And that would be disastrous. We'll be given this marvelous teaching by the Buddha, and we should ensure that we practice them fully. Otherwise, we have a problem. Okay, let's have another break. Okay. Okay, so any questions or comments from anyone about what we're doing? Yes, please, sir. That would be great if you don't mind. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense what you've been saying about how none of the steps are enough on their own and none of them are more important than the others. But I was just wondering why it is that meditation, there's so much more emphasis placed on meditation. Even here, you know, you go on retreats and we spend 10 days meditating, but then we don't spend 10 days learning about right view. Is it just because it's a practice, or is it because it's towards the end, or I was just wondering why?
Yeah. Do you want to say anything? Yeah.
I have to think about it.
Yeah, okay, I guess. Okay. So I think kind of because meditation is often kind of organized. Mm. You can't really organize right view in quite the same way. So I guess that's part of it. But I think it's an important point, though, because I think very often we don't underestimate some of those factors, yeah, especially like right view. And it's not as obvious. How do you get right view? It's not as obvious as how you meditate. You put your legs together and you watch your breath. It's kind of obvious. But right view is more like you have to study the word of the Buddha to some extent. You have to reflect on the word of the Buddha. Yeah, that's really how you get that right view. You hang out with the right people. You have the right mates, that kind of stuff. And that's how you end up having right view. Mm-hmm. But actually, right view is really fundamental, because the more, this is kind of the one thing that when you become a stream mentor, when you see these teachings fully for the first time, that is the one thing that you perfect, right view. Yeah. And together with that comes the perfection of the right morality. Mm-hmm. But the right view is really the thing that you perfect. So it's really, really important. So you're right. So we should find a balance in these things. And when you find a balance in these things, they actually do all support each other. So you meditate, that makes you understand more about the value of ethics and morality, practice more of that. It makes you more interest in the sutta. When you see the meditation work, makes you more interest in the suttas, right? Because you think, well, the Buddha is onto something. Yeah. And then everything kind of comes together in that way. Huh?
Okay.
But it is a good point. Yeah,
yes.
Thanks.
Cheers, thank you.
Yeah. Yes, please. Do you want to add something?
I don't know. From the beginning, it's a good question. It really is. And I wondered if in the beginning, when I started, why I was going to a different groups of Buddhist groups or meditation groups, and why weren't they teaching these things? And sometimes I felt that they were thinking maybe that they don't want to turn this into religion. We don't need to believe the certain dogmas. We don't need to follow what I have to say. Just meditate and be. You know, that's good enough. And sometimes we can be quite dogmatic within Buddhist as well, so we definitely shouldn't turn into that, but we cannot leave any of these things out. That's correct. I mean, we have to remind as a teachers, no, you have to keep your sila. Yeah. You have to do kindness, you know, just, yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point, actually, because many people are like, they're already kind of quit another religion, and they're kind of fed up with dogmas and fed up with kind of saying, this is the way things are, and now we just want to kind of have something which is more secular, where you're more kind of independent and you look after yourself, maybe. It could be part of it, actually.
Yeah.
Mm. Please, yeah.
Thank you, Ajahn. Just now you mentioned that in one of the sutta references that, you know, kindness is just as important, you need it, if not your mindfulness is limited. So how do the Brahma Viharas fit into the Noble Eightfold Path? Yeah, because it's not any one of it, actually. Yeah, thank you.
New Yoga side.
Okay, yeah. So the Brahma Viharas, the way that they are explained in the suttas, they are very lofty kind of stages of mind, really, really lofty, where you have the metta to all four directions with a mind completely free of ill will, and it's this extraordinary lofty state of mind. So the Brahma Viharas is basically comes at very kind of, you know, very late in the path, in a sense, at least the way it is described in the suttas. But prior to that, you still practice the Brahma Viharas, but in a more basic way. And the way to practice the Brahma Vihara in daily life is just how you treat the people around you. Yeah, do you speak with kindness? Do you act with kindness? Do you give chai, iced chai to people? That kind of thing. Yeah, And as you do that, you are that is how you practice the Brahmavihara initially. Then you move on to the mental realm. And in the mental realm, you also start in easier ways by how you think about the people around you. Do you give people a break? Are you critical of people, or do you give them a break? If you see people doing things that seem bad or wrong, usually the assumption can be that they have something in the background which makes them do bad things. Yeah, that they have some problem in their life, that they have been conditioned in a certain way, that they have had a bad day or whatever. That is the right way to think. They are basically deluded. They don't know what they're doing. They're blind, whatever you want to say, walking in darkness. When you think about people in that way, then you're always giving them a break. When you give other people a break, you're also giving yourself a break, because there isn't really no distinction between yourself and others. Then you also have more kindness towards yourself. Kindness to others always leads to kindness to yourself as well. Huh? And then once you are able to practice kindness through body and speech and also through mind in this way in your daily life, that is when it starts to become possible to do the Brahmaviharas as a meditation practice. Yeah. Very often it happens through, maybe you use mindfulness of breathing first, and then when you have some beautiful mindfulness of breathing, then the kind of the mind inclines naturally to having compassion and metta to the whole world. So you have to know where to start in the right way, because if you start in the wrong place, it was never going to happen. You have to start with daily life. This was one of the beautiful teachings. Sometimes as a monk, you're very lucky because you get to meet some really remarkable people. And sometimes I ask these people I meet, you know, often they happen to be monks, because as a monk, you meet mostly other monks. That's kind of the way it is. And as someone has asked, well, you know, someone who looks like they have this endless amount of metta, yeah, loving kindness, endless amount of loving kindness. And so I asked them, well, you know, I think, wow, I feel you have so much metta. How do you do it? And they say, oh yeah, when you wake up in the morning, you just decide, today I'm going to do good things to other people. And this is someone who has enormous amounts of metta, yeah? But the way they practice it is just so simple and so down to earth. And it's not like sitting in meditation, may all beings be happy and well, you know? It's not like that. It doesn't work anyway, because your mind isn't ready for it. And that is really, that's how I, yeah. Yeah.
Where it fits in the path, it fits everywhere.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. I mean, it's in just before samadhi and after samadhi, and it's a right view to have metta, and you know, it's a right
attention, effort,
intention. Yeah. But yeah, so it's everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. I was only wanting to give you a comment about it, because she was asking where in the path it is. Mm. And I have heard often you mention about it in the right intention. Like this avyapada sankappa is not only about refraining from ill will, but also actively cultivating. Yeah. And that is where the Brahmaviharas come in as well, in the path. Yeah. So,
that's a good point. And that is before morality. So it includes all the other factors, includes the morality. Yeah, so it's a good point. Yeah.
So always in Buddhism, we have to remember that when we have morality, sila, what are we talking about? Is that it's not just we restrain ourselves. We keep, you know, this is how you have to behave. We also have, in Buddhism, we also always have the negativity, but we always have the positive side. We actively do nice things, you know, actively have loving kindness. So that's the opposite side of, you know, you actively not harm others. But the other side is do good, be a good person. So that's the opposite.
Would you like some chai, iced chai tea?
I still have coffee.
Okay, trying.
My heartbeat is like 180.
Is it already? Okay. Yeah.
That's why I can.
Yeah. Okay. We're gonna take this question. Thank you for your questions from overseas. That's marvelous. We are definitely going to talk about this. But before we do that, let's carry on a little bit, because if we don't carry on, we might get carried away. So I think. The next one. So we are not finished with all the misconceptions or the myths yet. So more myths. Are you ready for more myths? We're getting fed up with the myths. Okay, next myth. Oh, no, what happened?
I thought this is the break now.
Is it? No.
Oh, yeah. So
I think that's in the wrong place.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. Let's just carry on.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, no,
it's yours, isn't it? That now comes to rough.
Is it? Okay.
I think.
So... don't attach to the path. This is one of the myths you sometimes have. Don't attach to your views, don't attach to your morality, just relax. Yeah, where does that come from? And I think sometimes it comes from the idea that as a stream enterer, you don't have any sila bhatta paramasa. Yeah, the sila paramasa is the idea of attachment to sila, precepts or morality, bhatta or vatta, which is like observances or kind of behaviors that we do. So you don't attach to these things. That's where it comes from. Once you become a stream enterer, you no longer have that attachment to. And that is where it comes from. But the problem is that before you are a stream enterer, the point of stream entry is that because you see the nature, you see the Dhamma, you see things fully, it becomes part of you. Yeah, and of course, once it is part of you, once it's kind of ingrained into your psychology, you can't lose it anymore. That's why you don't have to attach, because you know these things. It is part of who you are. Before that, you will need some attachment. Yeah, if you have no attachment to your morality, you're going to break it any time the desire says, oh, I want to break my morality, you're going to break it because there's no attachment. You need a little bit of motivation or effort to hold on to these precepts. This is true also as a monastic, yeah? If you want to have a beer, you say, okay, I can't have a beer, yeah? So and it's the same for lay people and monastics. So you need to attach to the path, because if you don't attach to the path, this could happen, yeah? No attachment, you end up like this. Gee, that's pretty amazing. I don't know how they made that picture, but it's kind of awesome. So this might happen to you. This is called the wrong path in Buddhism. So, and the place in the suttas where this is talked about is in the simile of the raft, or it's called the Majjhima 22. Alagadupama Sutta. Thank you so much, Ananda. That's very good. It's good. It's good to have the lay people who sometimes they can kind of keep you in check and make sure they don't say anything completely wrong. Alagadupama Sutta. The simile of the snake is the meaning of that sutta. And there it talks about this idea of seeing the Dhamma as a raft. Yeah, mendicants, I will teach you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft. It is for crossing over, not for holding on. Yeah? And this is then used for people that when we have the Dhamma, we use it in a good way so as to practice, but we don't hold on to it in the same way with the raft. But actually that would be, in my opinion, a wrong way of understanding this simile. Why? Well, because of this. When they crossed over to the far shore, they would think, this raft has been very helpful to me. Riding on the raft and paddling with my hands and feet, I have safely crossed over to the far shore. Why don't I hoist it on my head and pick it up on my shoulders and go wherever I want? So this is the wrong kind of holding. Yeah, this is what it is meant by this. So the idea here is that once you have crossed over, then you let go of the raft. You don't let go of the raft midstream. If you let go of the raft midstream, you have a problem. You're going to drown, yeah? Especially if you can't swim, you have a serious problem. So there is a right time for holding on to the raft, and there's a right time for letting go. You hold on for dear life while you are in the middle of the river or the stream. Then when you get to the other shore, that is when you let go. And that is the same thing as with the Dhamma. In the Dhamma, it means that you hold on to the Eightfold Path, maybe not too tenaciously, yeah, but you hold on enough to enable you to practice. And then when you reach the other shore, either at stream entry or when you become an arahant, then you let go. And the reason you let go is because it's now part of you. You can't really... You can't lose it anymore. It's with you anyway. You don't need to hold on because the raft is kind of inside of you. Yeah? So the raft has already become part of you. So that is why you don't need to hold on anymore. And that is really, I think, the right way to understand the simile of the raft. Yeah? You let go. Once you are a stream entry, you can relax. No need to hold on anymore. But before you get to that point, you have to hold on. Otherwise, you're going to drown. So we should hold on a little bit, yeah? And this is an important point. Remember that when a stream enterer says he doesn't hold on to sila, to morality and views, that is the result of becoming a stream enterer. It is not the way to become a stream enterer. Huh? Yeah, you don't become a stream enterer by letting go. Huh? You become a stream enterer by holding on, and then the result of stream entry is that you let go. Two different things. Huh? Am I making any sense to anyone? Yeah? I'm glad to hear that. Sometimes you just talk and talk, and probably everybody just, you know, they think, whoa, what is he talking about? What does he say, this stuff? So I'm glad you're making sense, because, yeah. So would you like to add anything, Venerable?
No, yeah? Sometimes I thought, yeah, you know, this could also mean that once you're a stream winner, that the raft is still, you know, you're still holding into something, so you have to let it go. But this, you know, could it be other way of looking at it? No, that it says something holding on to you, going further from stream winner.
Something holding on. You don't need to hold on anymore because the path was with you, and regardless.
Yeah.
But what do you mean? Yeah.
That there's something. So basically, go from stream winner to non-returner.
Yeah.
Once returner, non-returner, Arhan. That the raft is now.
In your mind, yeah.
It's like you're dragging it along, so you have to let it go. In order to go to the next step.
So you need to let go of the Dhamma. You're not holding on to the Dhamma too much
so
at that point. Okay,
you might get angry if there's debates about Dhamma and you're holding on to the Dhamma or something like that, or you.
Yeah, probably some truth to that. That even as a stream mentor, you tend to hold on to a few things, and you don't let go of everything straight away. And that, depending on, the problem is that you're only partially purified as a stream mentor, and that because it's only partially, occasionally you will hold on wrongly. So you still need to practice, and that could be that you need to let go of the teachings a little bit.
Right.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
But until then.
Yeah.
Hold on to it for your dear life.
Hold on for your life, yeah. This is you, I think.
Oh, this is Sutta Nipata. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see what I found. So don't get attached to the path from Sutta Nipata, one of the bit of a obscure places of in Nikayas. Attachment to a view are not easily overcome. Having decided among teachings, one tightly grasps to a view. Therefore, among those bases of attachment, a person rejects and takes up teaching. One involved is embroiled in disputes about teachings. But how? About what could one dispute with one uninvolved? Nothing is taken up or rejected by him. He has shaken all views right here. So sometimes, I mean, sure, this is for a person who's enlightened. This Sutta Nipata text a bit obscure because they are verses. But what you could think about here, that once you have gone to the far shore, once you're enlightened, the people might argue with you about the Dhamma, but you don't dispute, you don't get involved, you don't reject them. There's the wrong view has sort of like fallen off from you, so you're not attached to that anymore. So you don't hold onto that view anymore. Quite often, especially amongst when you're not there yet, and somebody say something wrong about the path, and you have an idea, this is how it is, this is the teaching, this is who I am, this is how we should be practicing, you might get angry, and that's a wrong way to go about it. Until then, you know, don't get too worried about it. You might get sometimes a bit attached to the path, but at the end, once you're there, you're not even attached to the path anymore.
It says there that you have shaken off all views right there, right
there.
What does that mean, you've shaken off all views?
Right, yeah, I don't know.
It's interesting, right?
It is.
Because it sounds like, well, here you are, you become a stream enterer. Does that mean a stream enterer doesn't have any views?
I thought that would mean that was this would be a fully enlightened person. But
or full, or yeah. fully enlightened, yeah, yeah, either right. way. Yeah. But you have you are dittipatto, you have attained to view already when you're a stream enter, so you should be
right.
a stream enter as well.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess you haven't the right answer.
Well, I just like to torture it. No, I'm just testing you, seeing what's going on. But it's an interesting point, right?
It is, yeah.
Because it sounds like, when you read that on the surface of it, it sounds like you would not have any views anymore,
right.
yeah? But this is important to understand this in the right way. It doesn't mean that you haven't got any views. What it means is that you have shaken off attachment or holding
attachment.
To the views.
Yeah.
So if someone... You know, if you are a stream mentor and someone challenges you about something, you're never going to get upset or angry. You know the truth. You know it so deeply and so fully that it is impossible if other people challenge you and they disagree, well, you just shrug your shoulders and say, whatever, you know, that's your problem, not mine, because I know the truth. And you obviously don't. So, you know, and you're not really arrogant about it either. You just know the truth. And that's why you have no attachment. So when you're shaking off all views means that you don't have any... You know, you're really cool about these things. There is no holding on anymore. You can't really be rattled by anyone challenging you. And that is the meaning. And to know that that is the meaning, you have to see the context throughout the suttas to understand how it is used, etc.
Yeah, so you can find an interesting thing. But that's what I find from the Sutta Nipata. What's next? I wonder.
I think another view, I think.
Yeah. View, is it?
Another myth.
Oh, no,
yeah.
myth.
Let us stop there, though.
Yeah, I think it's a good point.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that would be interesting. What comes next?
Let's leave it. Yeah. Actually, yeah, I wish. Yeah, anyway. So that's it for now. So let's have a break, and we're going to have the meditation at 3:00. So you're very welcome to come to the meditation, of course. And then we will be back again, continue the last part of this thing at 4:00. So see you again at 4:00. Yeah. They came to the monastery recently, so yeah. Okay.
Will you be in?
I will be here unfortunately.
Oh.
Yeah.
She said she will come here.
She'll come here then. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Marvelous. Yeah. Great. Right.